to contact, she who made the literature endlessly fascinating. Of all the lords of the domination, she was the most shadowed, the most surrounded by myth, the least encumbered by historical fact. Some scholars called her the greatest beauty ever to have lived, claiming that simply to have seen her was to have fallen into her thrall. Some called her the true motive force of the domination. A few admitted that their documentaries were really little more than romantic fantasies. Others admitted nothing, while demonstrably embellishing. Bowman's had become perpetually bemused while still a student. Back in his attic, he spread his silken chart. His day had not been a complete waste. He had located a previously unknown menhir and had identified the spells it anchored, and he had found the Tel Curry site. That would buy the mutton and beans. He glared at the chart as if pure will might conjure the information he needed. There were two diagrams. The upper was a five-pointed star within a slightly larger circle. Such had been the shape of the Barrowland when newly constructed. The star had stood a fathom above the surrounding terrain, retained by limestone walls. The circle represented the outer bank of a moat, the earth from which had been used to build the barrows, the star, and a pentagon within the star. Today the moat was little more than boggy ground. Bisan's predecessors had been unable to keep up with nature. Within the star, drawn off the points where the arms met, was a pentagon another fathom high. It too had been retained, but the walls had fallen and become overgrown. Central to the pentagon, on a north-south axis, lay the great barrow where the Dominator slept. At the points of his chart star, clockwise from the top, Bowman's had penned the odd numbers from 1 to 9. Accompanying each was a name: Soulcatcher, Shapeshifter, Nightcrawler, Stormbringer, Bone Gnasher. The occupants of the 5 outer barrows had been identified. The 5 inner points were numbered evenly, beginning at the right foot of the arm of the star, pointing northward. At 4 was the Howler, at 8 the Limper. The graves of 3 of the 10 who were taken remained unidentified. "Who's in that damned 6th spot?" Bowman's muttered. He slammed a fist against the table. "Damn it!" 4 years, and he was no closer to that name. The mask concealing that identity was the one remaining substantial barrier. Everything else was plain technical application, a matter of negating ward spells, then of contacting the Great One in the central mound. The Wizards of the White Rose had left volumes bragging about their performances of their art, but not one word of where their victims lay. Such was human nature. Bisand bragged about the fish he caught, the bait he used, and seldom produced the veritable piscine trophy. Below his star chart, Bowman's had drawn a second, portraying the central mound. It was a rectangle on a north-south axis surrounded by and filled with ranks of symbols. Outside each corner was a representation of a menhir, which, on the Barrowland, was a 12-foot pillar topped by a two-faced owl's head. One face glared inward, the other out. The menhirs formed the corner posts anchoring the first line of spells warding the great barrow. Along the sides were the line posts, little circles representing wooden fetish poles. Most had rotted and fallen, their spells drooping with them. The Eternal Guard had no staff wizard capable of restoring or replacing them. Within the mound proper there were symbols ranked in 3 rectangles of declining size. The outermost resembled pawns, the next knights, and the inner elephants. The crypt of the Dominator was surrounded by men who had given their lives to bring him down. Ghosts were the middle line between old evil and a world capable of recalling it. Bowman's anticipated no difficulty getting past them. The ghosts were there, in his opinion, to discourage common grave robbers. Within the 3 rectangles, Bowman's had drawn a dragon with its tail in its mouth. Legend said a great dragon lay curled round the crypt, more alive than the lady or Dominator, catnapping the centuries away while awaiting an attempt to recall the trapped evil. Bowman's had no way of coping with the dragon, but he had no need either. He meant to communicate with the crypt, not to open it. Damn! If he could only lay hands on an old guardsman's amulet. The early guards had worn amulets which had allowed them to go into the Barrowland to keep it up. The amulets still existed, though they were no longer used. Bisand wore one. The others he kept squirreled away. Bisand. That madman. That sadist. Bowmans considered the monitor his closest acquaintance, but a friend. Never. No, never a friend. Sad commentary on his life that the man nearest him would be one who would jump at a chance to torture or hang him. What was that about retirement? Someone outside this forsaken forest had recalled the Barrowland. "Bowmans, are you going to eat?" Bowmans muttered imprecations and rolled his chart. The dream came that night. Something sirenic called him. He was young again, single, strolling the lane that passed his house. A woman waved. Who was she? He didn't know. He didn't care. He loved her. Laughing, he ran toward her. Floating steps. Effort took him no nearer. Her face saddened. She faded. "Don't go," he called. "Please." But she disappeared and took with her his son. A vast, starless night devoured his dream. He floated in a clearing within a forest, unseen. Slowly, slowly, a diffuse silver something limned the trees. A big star with a long silver mane. He watched it grow till its tail spanned the sky. Twinge of uncertainty. Shadow of fear. "It's coming right at me." He cringed, threw his arm across his face. The silver ball filled the sky. It had a face. The woman's face. "Bo, stop it!" Jasmine punched him again. He sat up. "Huh? What?" "You were yelling. That nightmare again." He listened to his heart hammer. Sighed. Could it take much more? He was an old man. "The same one." It recurred at unpredictable intervals. It was stronger this time. "Maybe you ought to see a dream doctor." "Out here," he snorted disgustedly. "I don't need a dream doctor anyway." "No, probably just your conscience, nagging you for luring Stancil back from Orr." "I didn't lure—" "Go to sleep." To his amazement, she rolled over, for once unwilling to pursue their squabble. He stared into the darkness. It had been so much clearer. Almost too crisp and obvious. Was there a meaning hidden behind the dream's warning against tampering? Slowly, slowly, the mood of the beginning of the dream returned, that sense of being summoned, of being but one intuitive step from heart's desire. It felt good. His tension drained away. He fell asleep smiling. Bisand and Bowmans stood watching guardsmen clear the brush from Bowmans's sight. Bowmans suddenly spat. "Don't burn it, you idiot! Stop him, Bisand!" Bisand shook his head. A guard with a torch backed away from the brush pile. "Son, you don't burn poison ivy. The smoke spreads the poison." Bowmans was scratching, and wondering why his companion was being so reasonable. Bisand smirked. "Get itchy just thinking about it, don't you?" "Yes." "There's your other itch," he pointed. Bowman saw his competitor, Men Fu, observing from a safe distance. He growled. "I never hated anybody, but he tempts me. He has no ethics, no scruples, and no conscience. He's a thief and a liar." "I know him, Bo, and lucky for you I do. Let me ask you something, Bisand. Monitor, Bisand. How come you don't aggravate him the way you do me? What do you mean, lucky?" "He accused you of resurrectionist tendencies. I don't shadow him because his many virtues include cowardice. He doesn't have the hair to recover prescribed artifacts." "And I do. That little wart libeled me, with capital crimes. If I weren't an old man—" "He'll get his, Bo. And you do have the guts. I've just never caught you with the inclination." Bowmans rolled his eyes. Here we go, the veiled accusations. Not so veiled, my friend. There's a moral laxness in you, an unwillingness to accept the existence of evil that stinks like an old corpse. Give it its head, and I'll catch you, Bo. The wicked are cunning, but they always betray themselves. For an instant, Bowmans thought his world was falling apart. Then he realized Bisand was fishing. A dedicated fisherman, the monitor. Shaken, he countered, I'm sick of your sadism. If you really suspected anything, you'd be on me like a snake on shit. Legality's never meant anything to you, guards. You're probably lying about Men Fu. You'd haul your own mother in on the word of a sorrier villain than him. You're sick, Bisand, you know that? Diseased. Right here. He tapped his temple. You can't relate without cruelty. You're pushing your luck again, Bo. Bowman's backed down. Fright and temper had been talking. In his own odd way, Bisand had shown him special tolerance. It was as though he were necessary to the monitor's emotional health. Bisand needed one person outside the guard whom he did not victimize, someone whose immunity repaid him in a sort of validation. I'm symbolic of the people he defends, Bowmans snorted. That was rich. That business about being retired, did he say more than I heard? Is he calling off all bets because he's leaving? Maybe he does have a sense for scofflaws. Maybe he wants to go out with a flash. What about the new man? Another monster, unblinkered by the gossamer I've spun across Bisan's eyes? Maybe someone who will come in like the bull into the corrida? And Tokar, the possible resurrectionist, how does he fit? What's the matter? Bisand asked. Concern colored his words. Ulcers bothering me. Bowmans massaged his temples, hoping the headache would not come too. Plant your markers. Men Fu might jump you right here. Yeah. Bowmans took a half-dozen stakes from his pack. Each trailed a strip of yellow cloth. He planted them. Custom dictated that the ground so circumscribed was his to exploit. Men Fu could make night raids, or whatever, and Bowmans would have no legal recourse. Claims had no standing in law, only in private treaty. The antique miners exercised their own sanctions. Men Fu was under every sanction but violence. Nothing altered his thieving ways. Wish Stancil was here, Bowmans said. He could watch at night. I'll growl at him. That's always good for a few days. I heard Stance was coming home.
Yeah, for the summer. We're excited. We haven't seen him in 4 years.
Friend of Tokar, isn't he? Bowmans whirled.
Damn you! You never let up, do you?
He spoke softly, in genuine rage, without the shouts and curses and dramatic gestures of his habitual semi-rage.
All right, Bo, I'll drop it. You'd better. You'd damned well better. I won't have you crawling all over him all summer. Won't have it, you hear?
I said I'd drop it. Chapter 8 The Barrowland. Corby came and went at will around the guard compound. The walls inside the headquarters building boasted several dozen old paintings of the Barrowland. He studied those often while he cleaned, shivering. His reaction was not unique. The Dominator's attempt to escape through Juniper had rocked the Lady's Empire. Stories of his cruelties had fed upon themselves and grown fat in the centuries since the White Rose laid him down. The Barrowland remained quiet. Those who watched saw nothing untoward. Morale rose. The old evil had shot its bolt. But it waited. It would wait throughout eternity, if need be. It could not die. Its apparent last hope was no hope. The Lady was immortal, too. She would allow nothing to open her husband's grave. The paintings recorded progressive decay, the latest dated from shortly after the Lady's resurrection. Even then, the Barrowland had been much more whole. Sometimes Corby went to the edge of town, stared at the great barrow, shook his head. Once there had been amulets which permitted guards safely within the spells, making the Barrowland lethal to allow for upkeep. But those had disappeared. The guard could but watch and wait now. Time ambled. Slow and gray and limping, Corby became a town fixture. He spoke seldom, but occasionally enlivened the lie sessions at Blue Willie with a woolly anecdote from the Forsberg campaigns. The fire blazed in his eyes then. No one doubted he had been there, even if he saw those days a little wall-eyed. He made no true friends. Rumor said he did share the occasional private chess game with the Monitor, Colonel Sweet, for whom he had done some special small services. And, of course, there was the recruit Case, who devoured his tales and accompanied him on his hobbling walks. Rumor said Corby could read. Case hoped to learn. No one ever visited the second floor of Corby's home. There, in the heart of the night, he slowly unraveled the treacherous mare's nest of a tale that time and dishonesty had distorted out of any parallel with truth. Only parts were encrypted. Most was hastily scribbled in Tel Curry, the principal language of the Domination Era. But scattered passages were in Ukiteli, a Tel Curry regional vulgate. Times were when, battling those passages, Corby smiled grimly. He might be the only man alive able to puzzle through those sometimes fragmentary sentences. "Benefit of a classical education," he would murmur with a certain sarcasm. Then he would become reflective, introspective. He would take one of his late-night walks to shake revenant memory. One's own yesterday is a ghost that will not be laid. Death is the only exorcism. He saw himself as a craftsman, did Corby. A smith. An armorer cautiously forging a lethal sword. Like his predecessor in that house, he had dedicated his life to the search for a fragment of knowledge. The winter was astonishing. The first snows came early, after an early and unusually damp autumn. It snowed often and heavily. Spring came late. In the forests north of the Barrowland, where only scattered clans dwelt, life was harsh. Tribesmen appeared bearing furs to trade for food. Factors for the furriers of ore were ecstatic. Old folks called the winter a harbinger of worse to come. But old folks always see today's weather as more harsh than that of yore, or milder. Never, never the same. Spring sprung. A swift thaw set the creeks and rivers raging. The great tragic, which looped within 3 miles of the Barrowland, spread miles beyond its banks. It abducted tens and hundreds of thousands of trees. The flood was so spectacular that scores from town wandered out to watch it from a hilltop. For most, the novelty faded. But Corby limped out any day Case could accompany him. Case was yet possessed of dreams. Corby indulged him.
"Why so interested in the river, Corby?"
"I don't know. Maybe because of its grand statement."
"What?"
Corby swung an encompassing hand.
"The vastness. The ongoing rage. See how significant we are."
Brown water gnawed at the hill, furious, fumbling forests of driftwood. Less turbulent arms hugged the hill, probed the woods behind. Case nodded.
"Like the feeling I get when I look at the stars."
"Yes, yes. But this is more personal. Closer to home. Not so?"
"I guess."
Case sounded baffled. Corby smiled. Legacy of a farm youth.
"Let's go back. It's peaked, but I don't trust it with those clouds rolling in."
Rain did threaten. Were the river to rise much more, the hill would become an island. Case helped Corby cross the boggy parts and up to the crest of the low rise, which kept the flood from reaching cleared land. Much of that was a lake now, shallow enough to be waded if some fool dared. Under gray skies, the great barrow stood out poorly, reflecting off the water as a dark lump. Corby shuddered.
"Case, he's still there."
The youth leaned on his spear, interested only because Corby was interested. He wanted to get out of the drizzle.
"The Dominator, lad. Whatever else did not escape. waiting, filling with ever more hatred for the living.
Case looked at Corby. The older man was taut with tension. He seemed frightened.
If he gets loose, pity the world.
But didn't the lady finish him in Juniper?
She stopped him. She didn't destroy him. That may not be possible. Well, it must be. He has to be vulnerable somehow. But if the White Rose couldn't harm him...
The Rose wasn't so strong, Corby. She couldn't even hurt the Taken, or even their minions. All she could do was bind and bury them. It took the Lady and the Rebel.
The Rebel? I doubt that. She did it.
Corby lunged forward, forcing his leg. He marched along the edge of the lake. His gaze remained fixed on the great barrow. Case feared Corby was obsessed with the Barrowland. As a guard, he had to be concerned. Though the Lady had exterminated the Resurrectionists in his grandfather's time, still that mound exerted its dark attraction. Monitor Sweet remained frightened someone would revive that idiocy. He wanted to caution Corby, could think of no polite way to phrase himself. Wind stirred the lake. Ripples ran from the barrow toward them. Both shivered.
"Wish this weather would break,"
Corby muttered.
"Time for tea."
"Yes." The weather continued chill and wet. Summer came late. Autumn arrived early. When the great tragic did at last recede, it left a mud plain strewn with the wrecks of grand trees. Its channel had shifted a half mile westward. The woodland tribes continued selling furs. Serendipity. Corby was near done renovating. He was restoring a closet. In removing a wooden clothes rod, he fumbled. The rod separated into parts when it hit the floor. He knelt. He stared. His heart hammered. A slim spindle of white silk lay exposed. Gently, gently, he put the rod back together, carried it upstairs. Carefully, carefully, he removed the silk, unrolled it. His stomach knotted. It was Bowman's chart of the Barrowland, complete with notes about which Taken lay where fetishes were located and why, the puissance of protective spells, and a scatter of known resting places for minions of the Taken who had gone into the ground with their captains. A cluttered chart, indeed, mostly annotated in Tel Curry. Also noted were burial sites outside the Barrowland proper. Most of the ordinary fallen had gone into mass graves. The battle fired Corby's imagination. For a moment he saw the Dominator's forces standing firm, dying to the last man. He saw wave after wave of the White Rose Horde give themselves up to contain the shadow within the trap. Overhead, the great comet seared the sky, a vast, flaming scimitar. He could only imagine, though. There were no reliable histories. He commiserated with Bowman's. Poor, foolish little man, dreaming, seeking the truth. He had not earned his dark legend. Corby remained fixed over the chart all night, letting it seep into bone and soul. It did little to help him translate, but it did illuminate the Barrowland some, and even more, it illuminated a wizard so dedicated he had spent his entire adult life studying the Barrowland. Dawn's light stirred Corby. For a moment he doubted himself. Could he become prey to the same fatal passion? Chapter 9. The Plain of Fear.
The lieutenant himself stirred me out. "Elmo's back, Croker. Eat some breakfast, then report to the conference room."
He was a sour man, getting sourer every day. Sometimes I regret having voted for him after the captain died in Juniper. But the captain wished it. It was his dying request.
"Be there soonest," I said, piling out with my customary growl. I grabbed clothing, stirred papers, silently mocked myself. How often did I doubt voting for the captain himself?
Yet when he wanted to resign, we did not let him. My quarters look nothing like a physician's den. The walls are floor-to-ceiling with old books. I have read most, after having studied the languages in which they are written. Some are as old as the company itself, recounting ancient histories. Some are noble genealogies stolen from widely dispersed old temples and civil offices. The rarest and most interesting chronicle the rise and growth of the domination. The rarest of all are those in Tel Curry. The followers of the White Rose were not gentle victors. They burned books and cities, transported women and children, profaned ancient works of art and famous shrines, the customary afterglow of a great conflagration. So there is little left to key one into the languages and thinking and history of the losers. Some of the most plainly written documents I possess remain totally inaccessible. How I wish Raven were with us still, instead of dwelling among the dead men. He had a passing familiarity with written Tel Curry. Few outside the lady's intimate circle do. Goblin stuck his head in. "You coming or not?" I cried on his shoulder. It was the old lament. No progress. He laughed. "Go blow in your girlfriend's ear. She might help." "When will you guys let up?" It had been 15 years since I wrote my last simple-minded romance about the lady. That was before the long retreat which led the rebel to his doom before the tower at Charm. They do not let you forget.
"Never, Croker. Never. Who else has spent the night with her? Who else goes carpet-flying with her?"
I would rather forget. Those were times of terror, not romance. She became aware of my analytic endeavors and asked me to show her side, more or less. She did not censor or dictate, but did insist I remain factual and impartial. I recall thinking she expected defeat, wanted an unbiased history set down somewhere. Goblin glanced at the mound of documents.
"You can't get any handle on it?"
"I don't think there is a handle. Everything I do translate turns out a big nothing. Somebody's expense record, an appointment calendar, a promotions list, a letter from some officer to a friend at court. Everything way older than what I'm looking for." Goblin raised an eyebrow. "I'll keep on trying." There was something there. We took them from Whisper when she was a rebel. They meant a lot to her. And our mentor then, Soul Catcher, thought them of empire-toppling significance. Thoughtfully, Goblin remarked,
"Sometimes the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Maybe you should look for what ties it all together."
The thought had occurred to me. A name here, there, elsewhere, revealing the wake of someone through his or her earlier days. Maybe I would find it. The comet would not return for a long time. But I had my doubts. Darling is a young thing yet, just into her middle 20s. But the bloom of youth has abandoned her. Hard years have piled on hard years. There is little feminine about her. She had no chance to develop in that direction. Even after 2 years on the plane, none of us think of her as woman. She is tall, maybe 2 inches under 6 feet. Her eyes are a washed-out blue that often seems vacant, but they become swords of ice when she is thwarted. Her hair is blonde, as much from exposure to the sun. Without continuous attention, it hangs in straggles and strings. Not vain, she keeps it shorter than is stylish. In dress, too, she leans toward the utilitarian. Some first-time visitors are offended because she dresses so masculine, but she leaves them with no doubts that she can handle business. Her role came to her unwanted, but she has made peace with it, has assumed it with stubborn determination. She shows a wisdom remarkable for her age, and for one handicapped as she is. Raven taught her well during those few years he was her guardian. She was pacing when I arrived. The conference room is earth-sided, smoky, crowded even when empty. It smells of long occupation by too many unclean men. The old messenger from Orr was there, so were Tracker and Corder and several other outsiders. Most of the company were present. I finger-signed a greeting. Darling gave me a sisterly hug, asked if I had any progress to report. I spoke for the group and signed for her. "I'm sure we don't have all the documents we found in the Forest of Cloud. Not just because I can't identify what I'm looking for, either.
Everything I do have is too old. Darling's features are regular. Nothing stands out. Yet you sense character, will, that this woman cannot be broken. She has been to hell already. It did not touch her as a child. She will not be touched now. She was not pleased. She signed, "We will not have the time we thought." My attention was half elsewhere. I had hoped for sparks between Tracker and the other Westerner. On a gut level, I had responded negatively to Tracker. I found myself with an irrational hope for evidence to sustain that reaction. Nothing. Not surprising. The cell structure of the movement keeps our sympathizers insulated from one another. Darling wanted to hear from Goblin and One-Eye next. Goblin used his squeakiest voice.
"Everything we heard is true. They are reinforcing their garrisons. But Corder can tell you better. For us, the mission was a bust. They were ready. They chased us all over the plain. We were lucky to get away. We didn't get no help, either.
The Menhirs and their weird pals are on our side, supposedly. Sometimes I wonder. They are unpredictable. They help or don't according to a formula only they understand." Darling was little interested in details of the failed raid. She moved on to Corder. He said,
"Armies are gathering on both sides of the plain, under command of the Taken."
"Taken?" I asked. I knew of only the two. He sounded like he meant many. A chill, then. There is a long-time rumor that the Lady has been quiet so long because she is raising a new crop of Taken. I had not believed it. The age is sorrowfully short of characters of the magnificently villainous vitality of those the Dominator took in olden times. Soulcatcher, the Hanged Man, Nightcrawler, Shapeshifter, the Limper, and such. Those were nasty men of the grand scope, nearly as wild and hairy in their wickedness as the Lady and Dominator themselves. This is the era of the weak sister, excepting only Darling and Whisper. Corder responded shyly.
"The rumors are true, Lord."
"Lord? Me? Because I stand near the heart of the dream. I hate it, yet eat it up."
"Yes?"
"They may not be Stormbringers or Howlers, these new Taken," he smiled feebly. "Sir Tucker observed that the old Taken were wild devils, as unpredictable as the lightning."
"And the new ones are the predictable, tame thunder of bureaucracy, if you follow my meaning."
"I do. Go on."
"It is believed there are 6 new ones, Lord. Sir Tucker believes they are about to be unleashed, thus the great build-up around the plain. Sir Tucker believes the Lady has made a competition of our destruction."
Tucker, our most dedicated agent, one of the few survivors of the long siege of Rust. His hatred knows no bounds.
Corder had a strange look, a green around the edges look, a look that said there was more and all bad.
"Well," I said, "spit it out."
"The names of the Taken have been inscribed on stele raised in their respective domains. At Rust, the army commander is named Benefice. His stele appeared after a carpet arrived by night. He has not actually been seen."
That bore investigation. Only the Taken can manage a carpet. But no carpet can reach Rust without crossing the Plain of Fear. The Menhirs have reported no such passage.
Benefice. Interesting name. The others?
In Thud, the stele bears the name Blister.
Chuckles. I said, "I liked it better when the names were descriptive, like the Limper, Moonbiter, the Faceless Man.
At Frost, we have one called the Creeper."
"That's better." Darling gave me a cautionary look.
"At Rue, there is one called Learned, and at Hull, one called Scorn."
"Scorn. I like that, too."
"The western bounds of the plain are held by Whisper and Journey, both operating from a village called Spit."
Being a natural mathematical phenom, I summed and said, "That's 5 new ones and 2 old. Where is the other new one?"
"I don't know. The only other is the commander over all. His stele stands in the military compound outside Rust."
The way he said that abraded my nerves. He was pale. He started shaking. A premonition gripped me. I knew I would not like what he said next, but...
Well? That stela bears the sigil of the Limper.
Right. So right. I did not like it at all. The feeling was universal.
Oh!
Goblin shrieked. One Eye said, Holy shit, in a soft, awed tone that was all the more meaningful for its reserve. I sat down, right there, right in the middle of the floor. I folded my head in my hands. I wanted to cry. Impossible, I said. I killed him, with my own hands. And saying it, I did not believe it any more, though I had had faith in that fact for years. But how? Can't keep a good man down, Elmo chided. That he was shaken was evidenced by the smart remark. Elmo says nothing gratuitously. The feud between the Limper and the company dates to our arrival north of the Sea of Torments, for it was then that we enlisted Raven, a mysterious native of Opal, a man of former high estate who had been done out of his titles and livings by minions of the Limper. Raven was as tough as they come, and utterly fearless. The robbery sanctioned by Taken or not, he struck back. He slew the villains, among them the Limper's most competent people. Then our path kept crossing the Limper's, each time something worsened the weather between us. In the confusion after Juniper, Limper thought to settle with us. I engineered an ambush. He charged in. I would have bet anything I killed him. I tell you, at that moment, I was as rattled as I ever have been. I was on the precipice of panic. One Eye noticed. Don't get hysterical, Croaker. We survived him before. He's one of the old ones, idiot. One of the real Taken. From times when they had real wizards. And he's never really been allowed to go full speed at us before, and with all that help. 8 Taken and 5 armies to assault the Plain of Fear. Seldom were there more than 70 of us here in the hole. My head filled with terrible visions. Those Taken might be second-rate, but they were so many. Their fury would fire the plain. Whisper and the Limper have campaigned here before. They are not ignorant of the plain's perils. In fact, Whisper battled here both as a rebel and as Taken. She won most of the most famous battles of the Eastern War. Reason reasserted itself, but did little to brighten tomorrow. Once I thought, I reached the inescapable conclusion that Whisper knows the plane too well. Might even have allies out here. Darling touched my shoulder. That was more calming than any words from friends. Her confidence is contagious. She signed, Now we know, and smiled. Still, time has become a hanging hammer about to fall. The long wait for the comet has been rendered irrelevant. We have to survive right now. Trying for a bright side, I said, The Limper's true name is somewhere in my document collection. But that recalled my problem. Darling, the specific document I want is not there. She raised an eyebrow. Unable to speak, she has developed one of the most expressive faces I've ever seen. We have to have a sit-down, when you have time, to go over exactly what happened to those papers while Raven had them. Some are missing. They were there when I turned them over to Soulcatcher. They were there when I got them back from her. I am sure they were there when Raven took them. What happened to them later? Tonight, she signed, I will make time. She seemed distracted suddenly, because I mentioned Raven. He meant a lot to her, but you'd think the edge would be off by now. Unless there was more to the story than I knew, and that was plenty possible. I really have no idea what their relationship became in the years after Raven left the company. His death certainly bothers her still, because it was so pointless. I mean, after surviving everything the Shadow threw his way, he drowned in a public bath. The lieutenant says there are nights she cries herself to sleep. He does not know why, but he suspects Raven is at the root. I have asked her about those years when they were on their own, but she will not tell the tale. The emotional impression I get is one of sorrow and grave disappointment. She pushed her troubles away now, turned to Tracker and his mutt. Behind them, the men Elmo caught on the bluff squirmed. Their turn was coming. They knew the reputation of the Black Company. But we did not get to them, nor even to Tracker and Toadkiller Dog, for the watch above shrieked another alert. This was getting tiresome. The rider crossed the stream as I entered the corral. Water splashed. His mount staggered. It was covered with foam. Never again would it run well. It hurt me to see an animal so broken, but its rider had cause. Two Taken darted about just beyond the bound of the null. One flung a violet bolt. It perished long before it reached us. One Eye cackled and raised a middle finger. Always wanted to do that. Oh, wonder of wonders, Goblin squeaked, looking the other way. A number of mantas, big bluebacks, soared off the rosy bluffs, caught updrafts. Must have been a dozen, though they were hard to count, maneuvering as they did to avoid stealing one another's wind. These were giants of their kind. Their wings spanned almost 100 feet. When they were high enough, they dove at the Taken in pairs. The rider halted, fell. He had an arrow in his back. He remained conscious just long enough to gasp, "Tokens!" The first manta pair, seeming to move with slow, stately grace, though actually they streaked 10 times faster than a man can run, ripped past the nearer Taken just inside Darling's Null. Each loosed a brilliant lightning bolt. Lightning could speed where Taken witchery would not survive. One bolt hit. Taken and carpet reeled, glowed briefly. Smoke appeared. The carpet twisted and spun earthward. We sent up a ragged cheer. The Taken regained control, rose clumsily, drifted away. I knelt by the messenger. He was little more than a boy. He was alive. He had a chance if I got to work. A little help here, One Eye. Manta pairs ripped along the boundary of the null, blasting away at the second Taken. This one evaded effortlessly, did nothing to fight back. That's Whisper, Elmo said. Yeah, I said. She knows her way around. One Eye grumbled. You're going to help this kid or not, Croaker? All right, all right. I hated to miss the show. It was the first I had seen so many mantas, the first I had seen them support us. I wanted to see more. Well, said Elmo, while calming the boy's horse and going through his saddlebags, another missive for our esteemed analyst. He proffered another oilskin packet. Baffled, I tucked it under my arm, then helped One Eye carry the messenger down into the hole. Chapter 10 Bowman's Story. Croaker. Jasmine's squeal rattled the windows and doors.
Bowman's, you come down here. Come down right now, you hear me?
Bowman sighed. A man couldn't get 5 minutes alone. What the hell did he get married for? Why did any man? You spent the rest of your life doing hard time, doing what other people wanted, not what you wanted.
Bowman's, I'm coming, damn it!
Damned woman can't blow her nose without me there to hold her hand, he added sotto voce. He did a lot of talking under his breath. He had feelings to vent and peace to maintain. He compromised. Always he compromised. He stamped downstairs, each footfall a declaration of irritation. He mocked himself as he went. You know you're getting old when everything aggravates you.
What do you want? Where are you?
In the shop. There was an odd note in her voice. Suppressed excitement, he decided. He entered the shop warily.
Surprise!
His world came alive. Grouchiness deserted him.
Stance!
He flung himself at his son. Powerful arms crushed him.
Here already. We didn't expect you till next week.
I got away early. You're getting pudgy, Pop. Stancil opened his arms to include Jasmine in a 3-way hug.
That's your mother's cooking. Times are good. We're eating regular. Tokar's been...
He glimpsed a faded, ugly shadow.
So how are you? Back up. Let me look at you. You were still a boy when you left.
And Jasmine.
Doesn't he look great? so tall and healthy, and such nice clothes. Mock concern. You haven't been up to any funny business, have you?
Mother, what could a junior instructor get up to?
He met his father's eye, smiled a smile that said, same old mom. Stansel was 4 inches taller than his father, in his middle 20s, and looked athletic despite his profession. More like an adventurer than a would-be don, Beaumans thought. Of course, times changed. It had been eons since his own university days. Maybe standards had changed. He recalled the laughter and pranks and all-night, dreadfully serious debates on the meaning of it all, and was bitten by an imp of nostalgia. What had become of that mentally quick, foxy young Beaumans? Some silent, unseen guardsman of the mind had interred him in a barrow in the back of his brain. And there he lay, dreaming, while a bald, jowly, pot-bellied gnome gradually usurped him. They steal our yesterdays and leave us no youth but that of our children.
Well, come on, tell us about your studies.
Get out of that self-pitying mindset, Beaumans, you old fool.
4 years and nothing but letters about doing laundry and debates at the Stranded Dolphin. Stranded he would be in ore. Before I die, I want to see the sea. I never have.
Old fool. Dream out loud, and that's the best you can do. Would they really laugh if you told them the youth is still alive in there somewhere?
His mind wanders, Jasmine explained. Who are you calling senile? Beaumans snapped.
Pop, Mom, give me a break. I just got here.
Beaumans gobbled air. He's right. Peace, truce, armistice. You referee, Stance. The two old war horses like us are set in their ways.
Jasmine said,
Stance promised me a surprise before you came down.
Well? Beaumans asked.
I'm engaged, to be married.
How can this be? This is my son, my baby. I was changing his diapers last week.
Time, thou unspeakable assassin, I feel thy cold breath. I hear thine iron-shod hooves.
Humph, young fool.
Sorry.
Tell us about her, since you won't tell us about anything else.
I would if I could get a word in. Beaumans, be quiet. Tell us about her, Stance.
You probably know something already. She's Tokar's sister, Glory.
Beaumans's stomach plunged to the level of his heels.
Tokar's sister. Tokar, who might be a resurrectionist.
What's the matter now, Pop?
Tokar's sister, eh? What do you know about that family?
What's wrong with them?
I didn't say anything was. I asked you what you know about them.
Enough to know I want to marry Glory. Enough to know Tokar is my best friend.
Enough to know if they're resurrectionists. Silence slammed into the shop. Beaumans stared at his son. Stansel stared back. Twice he started to respond, changed his mind. Tension rasped the air.
Pop...
That's what Besand thinks. The guard is watching Tokar, and me, now. It's the time of the comet, Stance. The 10th passage. Besand smells some big resurrectionist plot. He's making life hard. This thing about Tokar will make it worse.
Stancil sucked spittle between his teeth. He sighed.
Maybe it was a mistake coming home. I won't get anything done wasting time ducking Besand and fighting with you.
No, Stance, Jasmine said. Your father won't start anything. Bo, you weren't starting a fight. You're not going to start one.
My son engaged to a resurrectionist. He turned away, took a deep breath, quietly berated himself. Jumping to conclusions, on word no better than Besan's.
Son, I'm sorry. He's been riding me.
He glanced at Jasmine. Besand wasn't his only persecutor.
Thanks, Pop. How's the research coming?
Jasmine grumbled and muttered.
Beaumans said, This conversation is crazy. We're all asking questions and nobody is answering.
Give me some money, Bo, Jasmine said.
What for?
You two won't say hello before you start your plotting. I might as well go marketing.
Beaumans waited. She eschewed her arsenal of pointed remarks about woman's lot.
He shrugged, dribbled coins into her palm. "Let's go upstairs, Stance."
"She's mellowed," Stancil said as they entered the attic room.
"I hadn't noticed."
"So have you. But the house hasn't changed."
Bowman's lighted the lamp.
"Cluttered as ever," he admitted.
He grabbed his hiding spear. "Gotta make a new one of these. It's getting worn."
He spread his chart on the little table.
"Not much improvement, Pop."
"Get rid of Besand," he tapped the sixth barrow.
"Right there. The only thing standing in my way."
"That route the only option, Pop? Could you get the top two, or even one? That would leave you a 50-50 chance of guessing the other two."
"I don't guess. This isn't a card game. You can't deal a new hand if you play your first one wrong."
Stancil took the one chair, stared at the chart. He drummed the tabletop with his fingers. Bowman's fidgeted. A week passed. The family settled into new rhythms, including living with the monitor's intensified surveillance. Bowman's was cleaning a weapon from the Tel Curry site. A trove, that was. A veritable trove. A mass burial, with weapons and armor almost perfectly preserved. Stancil entered the shop. Bowman's looked up.
"Rough night."
"Not bad. He's ready to give up. Only came round once."
"Men Fu or Besand?"
"Men Fu. Besand was there a half dozen times."
They were working shifts. "Men Fu" was the public excuse. In reality, Bowman's hoped to wear Besand down before the comet's return. It was not working.
"Your mother has breakfast ready." Bowman's began assembling his pack.
"Wait up, Pop. I'll go too."
"You need to rest."
"That's all right. I feel like digging."
"Okay." Something was bothering the boy. Maybe he was ready to talk. They'd never done much of that. Their pre-university relationship had been one of confrontation, with Stance always on the defensive. He had grown these 4 years, but the boy was still there, inside. He was not yet ready to face his father, man to man. And Bowman's had not grown enough to forget that Stancil was his little boy. Those growths sometimes never come. One day the son is looking back at his own son, wondering what happened.
Bowman's resumed rubbing flakes off a mace. He sneered at himself.
"Thinking about relationships. This isn't like you, you old coot."
"Hey, Pop," Stance called from the kitchen. "Almost forgot. I spotted the comet last night."
A claw reached in and grabbed a handful of Bowman's guts.
The comet? Couldn't be. Not already. He was not ready for it.
"Nervy little bastard," Bowman spat.
He and Stancil knelt in the brush, watching Men Fu toss artifacts from their diggings.
"I ought to break his leg.
Wait here a minute. I'll circle around and cut him off when he runs."
Bowman snorted.
"Not worth the trouble."
"It's worth it to me, Pop, just to keep the balance."
"All right."
Bowman's watched Men Fu pop up to look around, ugly little head jerking like that of a nervous pigeon. He dropped back into the excavation. Bowman stalked forward. He drew close enough to hear the thief talking to himself.
"Oh, lovely, lovely. A stone fortune. Stone fortune. That fat little ape don't deserve it. All the time sucking up to Besand. That creep."
"Fat little ape? You asked for it." Bowman shed his pack and tools, got a firm grip on his spade. Men Fu came up out of the pit, his arms filled. His eyes grew huge. His mouth worked soundlessly. Bowman wound up.
"Now, Bo, don't be—"
Bowman swung. Men Fu danced, took the blow on his hip, squawked, dropped his burden, flailed the air, and toppled into the pit. He scrambled out the far side, squealing like a wounded hog. Bowman wobbled after him, landed a mighty stroke across his behind. Men Fu ran. Bowman charged after him, spade high, yelling, "Stand still, you thieving son of a bitch! Take it like a man!" He took a last mighty swing. It missed. It flung him around. He fell, bounced back up, continued the chase, sans avenging spade. Stancil threw himself into Men Fu's way. The thief put his head down and bulled through.
Bowmans plowed into Stancil. Father and son rolled in a tangle of limbs. Bowmans gasped. "What the hell? He's gone now." He sprawled on his back, panted. Stancil started laughing. "What's so damned funny?" The look on his face. Bowmans sniggered. "You weren't much help." They guffawed. Finally, Bowmans gasped. "I'd better find my spade." Stancil helped his father stand. "Pop, I wish you could have seen yourself." "Glad I didn't. Lucky I didn't have a stroke." He lapsed into a fit of giggles. "You all right, Pop?" "Sure. Just can't laugh and catch my breath at the same time. Oh, oh my. I won't be able to move again if I sit down." "Let's go dig. That'll keep you loose. You dropped the spade around here, didn't you?" "There it is." The giggles haunted Bowmans all morning. He would recall Menfu's flailing retreat, and his self-control would go. "Pop?" Stancil was working the far side of the pit. "Look here. This may be why he didn't notice you coming." Bowmans limped over, watched Stancil brush loose soil off a perfectly preserved breastplate. It was as black and shiny as rubbed ebony. An ornate ornament in silver bossed its center. Bowmans popped out of the pit. "Nobody around. That half-man, half-beast design. That's Shapeshifter. He led the Tel'Kuri. He wouldn't be buried here, though." "It's his armor, Pop." "I can see that, damn it." He popped up like a curious groundhog. No one in sight. "Sit up here and keep watch. I'll dig it out." "You sit, Pop." "You were up all night. I'm a lot younger than you are." "I'm feeling just fine, thank you." "What color is the sky, Pop?" "Blue." "What kind of question?" "Hallelujah, we agree on something. You're the most contrary old goat. Stancil." "Sorry, Pop." "We'll take turns. Flip a coin to see who goes first." Bowman's lost. He settled down with his pack as a backrest. "Going to have to spread the dig out. Going straight down like this, it'll cave in first heavy rain." "Yeah, be a lot of mud. Ought to think about a drainage trench." "Hey, Pop, there's nobody in this thing. Looks like the rest of his armor, too." Stancil had recovered a gauntlet and uncovered part of a greave. "Yeah? I hate to turn it in." "Turn it in? Why? Tokar could get a fortune for it." "Maybe so. But what if friend Menfu did spot it? He'll tell Bisand out of spite. We've got to stay on his good side. We don't need this stuff. Not to mention he might have planted it." "What?" "It shouldn't be here, right? And no body inside the armor? And the soil is loose." Bowmans grunted. Bisand was capable of a frame. "Leave everything the way it is. I'll go get him." "Sour-faced old fart," Stancil muttered as the monitor departed. "I bet he did plant it." "No sense cussing. We can't do anything." Bowmans settled against his pack. "What are you doing?" "Loafing. I don't feel like digging anymore." He ached all over. It had been a busy morning. "We should get what we can while the weather is good." "Go ahead." "Pop," Stancil thought better of it, "how come you and Mom fight all the time?" Bowmans let his thoughts drift. The truth was elusive. Stance would not remember the good years. "I guess because people change, and we don't want them to." He could find no better words. "You start out with a woman. She's magical and mysterious and marvelous, the way they sing it. Then you get to know each other. The excitement goes away. It gets comfortable. Then even that fades. She starts to sag and turn gray and get lined, and you feel cheated. You remember the fey shy one you met and talked with till her father threatened to plant a boot in your ass. You resent this stranger. So you take a poke. I guess it's the same for your mother. Inside, I'm still 20, Stance. Only if I pass a mirror, or if my body won't do what I want, do I realize that I'm an old man. I don't see the pot belly and the varicose veins and the gray hair, where I've got any left. She has to live with it. Every time I see a mirror, I'm amazed.
I end up wondering who's taken over the outside of me. A disgusting old goat, from the look of him. The kind I used to snicker at when I was 20. He scares me, Stance. He looks like a dying man. I'm trapped inside him, and I'm not ready to go. Stancil sat down. His father never talked about his feelings. Does it have to be that way? Maybe not, but it always is. Thinking about glory, Stance. I don't know. You can't get out of getting old. You can't get out of having a relationship change. Maybe none of it has to be, if we manage this. Don't tell me about maybes, Stance. I've been living on maybes for 30 years. His ulcer took a sample nibble from his gut. Maybe Bisand is right, for the wrong reasons. Pop, what are you talking about? You've given your whole life to this. What I'm saying, Stance, is that I'm scared. It's one thing to chase a dream. It's another to catch it. You never get what you expect. I have a premonition of disaster. The dream might be stillborn. Stancil's expression ran through a series of changes. But you've got to... I don't have to do anything but be Bowman's the Antiquary. Your mother and I don't have much longer. This dig should yield enough to keep us. If you went ahead, you'd have a lot more years and a lot more... I'm scared, Stance, of going either way. That happens when you get older. Change is threatening. Pop, I'm talking about the death of dreams, son. About losing the big, wild make-believes that keep you going. The impossible dreams. That kind of jolly pretend is dead for me. All I can see is rotten teeth in a killer's smile. Stancil hoisted himself out of the pit. He plucked a strand of sweet grass, sucked it while gazing into the sky. Pop, how did you feel right before you married Mom?
Numb. Stancil laughed.
Okay, how about when you went to ask her father, on the way there?
I thought I was going to dribble down my leg. You never met your grandfather. He's the one who got them started telling troll stories.
Something like you feel now.
Something, yes, but it's not the same. I was younger, and I had a reward to look forward to.
And you don't now. Aren't the stakes bigger?
Both ways, win or lose.
Know what? You're having what they call a crisis of self-confidence. That's all. Couple of days and you'll be raring to go again. That evening, after Stancil had gone out, Bowman's told Jasmine, "That's a wise boy we've got. We talked today. Really talked, for the first time. He surprised me."
"Why? He's your son, isn't he?"
The dream came stronger than ever before, more quickly than ever. It wakened Bowman's twice in one night. He gave up trying to sleep. He went and sat on the front stoop, taking in the moonlight. The night was bright. He could make out rude buildings along the dirty street. Some town, he thought, remembering the glories of ore. The guard, us antiquaries, and a few people who scratch a living serving us and the pilgrims. Hardly any of those anymore, even with the domination fashionable. The Barrowland is so disreputable, nobody wants to look at it. He heard footsteps. A shadow approached.
"Beau?"
"Bisand?"
The monitor settled on the next step down.
"What are you doing?"
"Couldn't sleep. Been thinking about how the Barrowland has gotten so..."